In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. It's never an easy call with so many problems in the world to know where to direct the money that you donate when you want to help out in this world. But what I can tell you is that when you donate to CAMH, you're saving lives. We know about the opioid crisis. We know about the mental health crisis. They are doing the work. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at CAMH.ca/CanadaLand to help us treat addiction and build hope. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to CanadaLand.com/join. And thank you.
Richard Vincent Mercer.
Wow.
OC.
Thank you for reading my Wikipedia entry.
I do my homework over here.
That's good.
Thank you for being here.
I'm happy to be here.
You know this part of town.
A little bit. Yeah, for sure. The alleys. The back
alley.
Alleys. Yeah.
The graffiti alley.
Yeah, the graffiti alley was a great gift to me, the graffiti alley. They treated me very well over the years. When we started the Mercer Report, we only knew two things. We were going to do the road.
Yeah.
But we were going to do the rant. And that was really important. And just logistically, the question was, where do we do the rant? And we found these graffiti alleys that were literally a 3-minute drive from the broadcasting center. As beautiful as the alleys are, it was challenging for a couple of just logistical reasons. There's a lot of entrances to actual functioning businesses, of course.
Yeah.
So the trucks are backing up, beep, 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 which would ruin a take. And as you know, there's nothing worse than the beep, beep, beep. There was that. There's a sex trade going on there.
Yeah.
There's rats. Over time, it became a gallery. Really, worse than the sex trade or the rats or the beeping of the trucks were the art students with the cameras, because
right.
You couldn't really like, they didn't really belong there.
Yeah.
You know, everyone else did. And that became super popular. As you know, it's a gallery, and I'm pleased for the artists, obviously. They got a steady stream of gawkers.
It's like a cross-section of Toronto there. It's definitely
– yeah.
Yeah. Are we cool? I've done – I'm coming up on 1,000 episodes, and
Are we cool?
Like, I can't remember – I've been talking about Canadian media people for 10 years now.
Oh, honestly, I have no idea.
Great.
Now, my partner
– yeah.
I think we are cool, because my partner said, oh, you should do that, because my partner has a memory, whereas I don't. Like, I'll say, oh, I like that guy. We should talk to him. And he'll say, yeah, do you remember what he said on your opening in the second year of the season? Do you remember that? And then he'll tell me. And I was like, oh,
right.
Did he?
You need
or
someone.
Sometimes you bump into people.
Yeah.
And you hear, they're like, oh, they're a little kind of weirded out because, you know, they said you were the most boring person in Canada. And my takeaway is like, well, they'll be really upset to know that I didn't even notice.
That is a really good skill. You know what it's like making content all the time and being critical. And I can't remember what I said a month ago. But when somebody says something nasty about me, I'm not like you. I'm not stoic. I know it. I have a list. I don't forget.
I don't have a list.
That's good.
I don't have a list. And two of the most successful people that I've seen in politics, Justin Trudeau being one of them, not this week, of course. I just watched him from afar and I heard this about him, but I did spend a lot of time with Belinda Stronach because we were involved in an anti-malaria effort together and we became friends. And I was amazed when she was in public office, first as a conservative, then changed, of course, crossed the floor, became a liberal. A lot of vitriol around that, as you can imagine. She didn't care a bit. People said the worst stuff.
Right.
And it was thus literally water off a duck's back like you cannot even imagine. Like not even a little tiny bit.
If I was an heiress to the Stronach fortune, I could brush that aside as well.
Well, no. No. A lot of people, just because of their position or their wealth, or they can still have a very thin skin.
Oh, even more so.
And apparently Trudeau is the same way. Apparently he doesn't care at all, which this week is probably going to serve him very well.
I did read your Wikipedia page, and I might have even done a little bit more research than that. And I realize we actually have something in common.
What's that?
You burst onto the scene as a media critic. You had a very angry take on a newspaper columnist.
Yeah.
You went further.
I didn't know where you were going with that. But yes, I guess I did.
You took it further than I've ever dared. You said, like, this guy needs to die.
I didn't say he needs to die. Although I subtitled my one-man show, Charles Lynch Must Die, which is only the kind of thing a 19-year-old would do.
I think my paraphrasing is fairly accurate.
If a young person did that today, I would be that member of the establishment going, you cannot do that. That is crossing a line. But I was 19. I was an angry young man.
Yeah.
I took the bait. I fully admit I took the bait. His tongue was in his cheek when he said all the terrible things about Newfoundland, for the most part. But he, of course, became a huge supporter of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And my one-man show, for viewers who are not ancient and didn't happen to be going to the theater at the time, it really did make my career. It went from being a small show in a 80, 70-seat theater in a garage in Ottawa to a pretty substantial Canadian tour, played here at the Factory for 8 weeks with a built-in holdover. It played Vancouver's Cultural Center. I spent an entire year touring the show. And everywhere I went, Charles Lynch, the guy in the subtitle, Charles Lynch Must Die, he and I would go on the radio together and we would scream at each other. He would say, like, he's made me the Salman Rushdie of Newfoundland. He's put a fatwa in my head. And he loved it and I loved it and we sold lots of tickets.
It became performance at a...
Absolutely. By the end of it, it was a dog and pony show. We had it all worked out.
It's good for him and good for you. But it started off with a lot of vinegar. Like, you know, that's a pretty big swing to take. But
sure.
More so than the live event, perhaps, you got the attention of the CBC and they put you on the air debating this.
Yeah.
Guy. Like, this is some like...
That was the other big thing that happened. I mean, to make a long story short, I had this show about the Meech Lake Accord of all things.
Yeah.
A big chunk of it. And the Meech Lake Accord was dominating headlines. But journalists, rightly so, they were struggling because... The story was changing, but it was still a constitutional crisis. It was a little bit boring. And suddenly we had this show.
Yeah.
And they started referring to the show, and the show became a thing. And then Midday said, well, why don't you guys go on television and debate the Meech Lake Accord?
This is a very familiar problem for me, to take something that matters a great deal.
Yeah.
But comes across as a dry policy issue that it's hard to engage people with.
Yeah.
And here you have like a personal conflict, or at least the appearance of one.
Yeah.
Here's this young upstart who's taking on one of the most powerful newspaper columnists. They're going to yell at each other. This guy must die. And they're going to – like it really breathes life and gets people engaged in something.
Yeah. I don't know if they knew what was going to happen, but they were having to cover Meech day after day. And someone said,
right,
okay, there's this columnist and there's this kid. And I was – I don't know if I've ever been more terrified in my life.
You don't look terrified. In the clip
– Oh, I can't – you watch the clip? Oh, well, I've never – no, I don't want to watch it.
I want to return to this journey from angry young man to establishment. You called yourself a member of the establishment. I think that's
right.
Accurate. But first, let's absolutely have a look at this clip.
I'm sorry. I don't think I've ever looked at it.
Okay. Here we go.
The perpetrator, Rick Mercer – is with us from St. John's. The victim, Charles Lynch, is with us from Ottawa. Now, Rick,
you're like licking your chops here waiting for the guy.
Not.
Look
I'm
at this.
Not.
Go into a little detail. What was it about it that just drove you out of your mind?
No, I missed it.
I assure you I am not licking my chops. I'm terrified.
Rick Mercer is with us from St. John's. The victim.
Look at that. There is.
It does look like I'm licking my chops.
Demonstrable licking of. Yeah.
You can't imagine how.
terrified I am. This is a man who's the former head of the Southern News Service. He wrote funny columns near the end of his life, but a giant intellect, and certainly had a grip on policy. And I was a kid who was pissed off. I didn't feel like I could get in there and debate him on the intricacies of Meech. I was terrified.
You look like you've been waiting your whole life for that moment, and you're having a grand time.
Well, that's great. And that's interesting because, again, I've never looked at it. You know, we all have a titch of the imposter syndrome. And I often came through something like that and thought, God, how did I get through that? And people still hired me. But you're right. I look like an incredibly confident young man who's just dying to take this guy on.
Which CBC liked what they saw. And basically that was almost like the template for decades of what followed.
I started doing, I guess, precursors to The Rant on Midday and a few other shows. And when what became This Hour's 22 Minutes was being discussed, George Anthony at the CBC ensured that I was in the room.
It's so interesting to me, these cycles. You look like a 50 Cent fan to me. Are you a fan of the rapper 50 Cent?
No. Don't take that the wrong way.
He burst onto
I'm not a fan of anything in the last 25 years.
All right. More of a Big L guy. All right. Yeah. But he burst onto the scene with a unauthorized, no major label street tape called How to Rob. And, we know about rappers like opening up beef with other rappers.
Sure.
He went for it and did a song in which he name checks about 50 different famous rappers and how he would rob them.
Right. Okay.
In one track, he insulted 50.
Right. So he opened up 50 fronts.
50 fronts. And four of them, like Jay-Z, Wyclef Jean, responded.
Took him on.
And all of a sudden, they're responding to 50 Cent.
He's in a serious war. What? There was a scene in Larry Sanders years ago. I'm not going to be able to quote it, but it was Larry was dating, I can't remember who it was, Sharon Stone or something. And Artie, the producer, was saying, if you get a superstar and then a star, the star will take heat away from the superstar and you will get bigger. And that's exactly what he obviously did. And what I did, I was in a ongoing battle with this guy who was a legend.
Yeah.
He was a legend in Canadian media. And I was a 19-year-old kid.
But he was generous enough to play with you and he got some shine off of it but built up your star as well.
Oh, he was incredibly generous. And I will just quickly say, just because I think it speaks so much to Charles, when I was doing the show in Vancouver, he started writing columns about he was quite sick. And I checked with people I knew, and they were like, oh, no, he's very, very sick. Like, he could be gone within a matter of weeks.
And you're touring a show.
I was touring a show.
He must die.
Charles Lynch must die. So I called him up. We didn't speak on the phone much. We weren't that close.
Right.
I called him up, and I said, oh, we're moving into Vancouver, and I'm going to take the subtitle off the show now. I think I've reached a point. It's just show me the button. I'll push it. And he said, why would you do that? And I said, well, Charles, you've written these columns about how you're dying, and no offense. Not to make it all about me, but if you die while I'm in Vancouver doing this show, this is a very bad look. And he said, how long is your run? And I said, I'm going to be out there for the next 2 months. And he said, I promise you I won't die. And so we stuck with Charles Lynch Must Die. And then when he did die, many years later, in fact, I was doing 22 minutes and I got an envelope in the mail and I opened it and it was the bulletin from his funeral. And there was a sticky note attached, and it said, Dear Rick, for your files, regards, Charles Lynch.
Excellent.
He got the last joke.
Yeah.
He got the last laugh. And on his deathbed, I guess, he wrote that and gave it to his son and said, mail that to Mercer when I'm gone, which is great.
That's amazing. 50 Cent, to return to the focus of our conversation, is now some decades later, I think, did the Super Bowl. He's like certainly the establishment of hip hop. And, there's an old joke on The Simpsons like 20 years ago, like the Dr. and Mrs. Dre Center for the Performing Arts or something.
Right.
And that's actually true now.
Right.
The road from being the kind of like violent upstart to being establishment, that cycle exists in the States, but it takes some time. It didn't take quite as long. You kind of rattled those cages and got in there real quick.
Well, This Hour's 22 Minutes happened.
Yeah.
So I had this platform then, and I stayed with that show for 8 years. And the show wasn't establishment, quote unquote, to start, but it became pretty, I don't know if mainstream is the right word, but it became very popular with really high ratings and was pretty influential, I think, at the time. And so whether we were establishment, I have no idea. But certainly with the Mercer report, as much as I'm loath to admit it, I realized that I was absolutely no longer the saucy young outsider who would take on someone like Charles Lynch and write Charles Lynch Must Die.
How do you mature into that? Because you still have as your Twitter bio, anger is my cardio. You don't seem that angry.
No,
and
in
fact, you've got much to be angry about.
Twitter is my, you know, anger is my cardio as my Twitter line is, it's more because I'm lazy and I haven't gotten around to changing it. I mean, how angry can I be? I drive a Volvo.
Right.
Like, you know,
is it important to
still get angry? I still get angry.
Should one be angry? Like I have lots of things to feel very grateful about too, and it's ridiculous to a lot of people, the idea that I – but it's like if the anger is what got you there, whether it's fueling one's comedy in your case or often the reason why that escalates people is because like they have something to say. It's somebody on the outside who's like dispossessed or marginalized, coming from Newfoundland, being young and angry, being young queer and like all of those things is kind of arms you with that energy that kind of got you in the door. Do you feel like that's like a childish thing to put away, or is that an important thing to hold on to?
I think it's two things. I certainly hold on to it. Recently, I started following on Facebook. Someone said, "Oh, you got to follow this site." I won't say what it is. It was kind of a confession site, one of those, and there was just a lot of weird confessions on there that were kind of funny and odd, and then the comments were kind of funny and odd. But as these things do, it has since evolved, and it's people, I'd say 80% of them now, are no longer weird confessions like, you know, I slept with my brother-in-law at my sister's wedding. Is that bad? It used to be that. And it's moved into people just venting about how hard they are struggling and how difficult a time they're having and how they feel with everything that they're about to go underwater. And it's heartbreaking. And now I just get angry every single time I read that group, whereas it used to just be amusing and weird. And now it just makes me angry. So I still get angry all the time. And that angers me. You know, you read about all of these people who are struggling to the extent that people are struggling. And, you know, it makes you not feel great about the country right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I know people have always struggled, but I feel like in my lifetime anyway, this is a completely new thing.
Yeah. And I think that you can see it. You can see it on Queen Street right by Graffiti Alley. But then I get reports.
You can see it everywhere. Every single city.
Yeah.
Every single downtown core. There's a lot of drugs, of course. And I feel like a crazy old man now going, it's the drugs. Because people said that when I was 18, 19 too. But it's with the fentanyl and the oxy and all that, it's a completely different animal, right?
But the leading politician who is campaigning on that issue, it's like history repeats itself again and again. The leading answer to these problems is to further remove a social safety net. And that seems to be resonating.
And I'm not an expert on this, but I can totally understand why a leading politician would start saying things like Canada's broken and pointing at tent cities and saying we're just going to clean it up, because what a simple solution that would be. And I think everyone looks at these tent cities and these situations and they feel terrible and they just don't know what the solution is. They just know it's getting worse. Now, I don't prescribe to, well, just clean it up, because I know that that's not the case. That's just not going to happen. These are people you're talking about. But I can totally understand why he's doing it.
See, this is what I oscillate between as well, because there is sort of this, for me, like kind of middle-aged kind of like shrug of like, what do you expect the guy to do? He's trying to win. And, you know, this is what has people concerned. And it's hanging right there as low-hanging fruit. You point to it and you say, look, we've got a prime minister here for many years and this is what the country looks like. They would do it on the other side if it was the conservatives in power. That's just the obvious thing. And then by the same token, it has real implications when he says these safe supply programs are to blame for this. And when I'm prime minister, we're going to get rid of them, because I know that the data shows that that's going to kill people. So it's like, do you get angry for somebody who's just performing their role? Like, it just feels often like we don't even have options to actually deal with the real problems that are happening, because everyone's just kind of running their algorithm.
That's exactly what they're doing. And if you're a liberal leader, you're sitting down and you're saying, okay, if we have this problem, what is something that will resonate with the people that can fit inside our liberal ideology? And if they're conservative, they do the same thing. And I don't know if the leader ever sits and goes, Well, hang on. But I don't – that doesn't square it with me. That's not what I think. I think they're just looking at the data.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing. And that's what Trudeau's doing. Well, I don't think Trudeau's doing much of anything right now. But if his head was in the game, that's what he would be doing. And that's absolutely what Poilievre is doing.
What should we be doing?
And when he first said Canada's broken.
Yeah.
Again, I thought I'd heard him say Canada feels broken. And then I heard him say Canada is broken. And I had one of those moments where I went, oops, he just made a mistake. He said Canada is broken when he's supposed to say Canada feels broken. But clearly it tested well because he's kept it up.
He keeps moving the needle and it keeps working for him.
Yeah. But if you read, going back to that Facebook group that I've been reading, mm-hmm. I can see how that message would be resonating with the people in that group because there's a lot of desperation there.
Yeah.
And they don't see a way through. And so when someone's offering a simple solution, you know, Doug Ford offered everyone, young people, a $500,000 home the other day. He was like a sales guy. He was like, I'm going to give you an 1,900 square foot home with a basement you can rent out with a paved driveway and a fence backyard for under $500,000. And I love that, a paved driveway. Like he threw that in.
Yeah.
Paved driveway.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's amazing the things that we tell ourselves to talk ourselves out of getting help. Anybody who's actually gotten help knows that the process of getting things off your chest, of taking your stressors, your problems, and just like not letting them be bottled up, working through just conveying them to somebody, half of the battle is just doing that. You unburden yourself. And you know what? If you have a real mental health professional, no, they don't have magic bullets or magic words that make it all go away. But often they can help you see things a little bit differently and guide you to strategies or tools or to a new perspective that actually does help. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Because you listen to this podcast, you get 10% off of your first month at BetterHelp.com/CanadaLand. That's BetterHelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer, and it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. I think that there is some kind of like straddling of comedy and journalism, and I have to credit you as a pioneer of it. I mean, when the fake news comedy about politics, guy who looks like an anchor but is actually taking the piss, when you did that, it was before that became a like mainstream genre everywhere.
It wasn't. You know, obviously Saturday Night Live always had Weekend Update, mm-hmm. but Weekend Update never ever tried to look like the news because they couldn't. They only had a little desk and a little bit of room. But Weekend Update was never – it was always popular with Saturday Night Live fans. And obviously it launched Chevy Chase. But according to Lorne Michaels anyway, who I don't know, but from what I gather, it was never a particularly popular part of the show with the mainstream audience. And the network wasn't particularly into it either. It was just one of those weird idiosyncrasies.
I didn't know that. I was a young comedy fan. Miller back, you know, just.
Yeah, but I think even before that, I think it was just part of Lorne Michaels' idiosyncrasy that he had this fake news thing going on.
Turning that into a show.
Yeah, why not just do another sketch?
But your project of like making that the show was a first, I guess.
Yeah, they were the only people who were doing it. And when we were creating the show, I was really inspired by a pilot that I had seen. Someone gave me a VHS one time of like 9 pilots that were never picked up
that should have been. And it was one of those VHSs, like you could barely see the show. And there was a show called, I believe it was called, was it called This Just In? And I believe Peter Callahan was in the pilot.
Uh-huh.
But it was set in a newsroom. And I think it was a knockoff of a remake of a British show, maybe. But anyway, to me, it was a revelation because it was this kind of basic sitcom. But then the news anchor sat down and then interviewed Ross Perot. And they were using satellite footage of Ross Perot and actually doing an interview. And when I saw that, my mind, it melted. I just didn't know you could do that. And when we sat in the room creating 22 Minutes, there was this guy, Jeff Dion, who came to work with us. And he was a CBC News producer. He ran the Supper Hour News in Halifax. And I started asking him all these technical questions like, are there really all these raw interviews just floating around in space? And can we get them? And is it legal? It must be legal. This show in the States did it. And he said, I think we could do that. And then he said, I will never work in news ever again. Like, this better work
because
I'll be murdered. And that was a big part of the impetus to create the News Desk.
As this thing that I think you did first took off and became this really important thing in the States, and from Jon Stewart to Trevor Noah and then Samantha Bee and Hasan Minhaj, like it just goes on, Michelle Wolf, like there are many of these shows. It took on a very different form and a different time slot and different tone than your work in Canada. It was a late night thing in the States, but it was a primetime family thing in Canada.
Yep.
It was more of a niche cable thing in the States. It was CBC, everyone's network here in Canada.
Yep.
And they really tried to like keep that edge really sharp. They were going for blood in the States. And in Canada, eventually we have you palling around with politicians.
Sure. Yeah.
And they're in on the joke and they don't really come out of it humiliated.
They never did.
Uh-huh.
They never did. In my stuff, they never did. When I talked behind their back, they were often humiliated, and I think that we did some very fine work that way. But when they were on the show, it was what I always referred to as a mutually parasitic situation. There was no doubt about it.
Mutually parasitic.
Yeah.
You're like, feeding off them and they're feeding off you.
Yeah, absolutely. And they knew. The very first time we had a politician on, it was just a fluke. I was shooting at a Preston Manning rally. This was when Preston Manning first became – well, he was leader of the Reform Party. I think it was his first time in Nova Scotia, first time he ever went to Eastern Canada. He was a very different person than the person he became. He had the thick glasses. He had this nasally voice. He was very, very droll. Not a lot of people paying attention to him in the East.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of rumors about him. Anyway, he was doing this rally and – we had never even thought of talking to a politician. And I just went up to him at the end because no one was really talking to him. And I said, can I just say to you, when are you going to do an interview with This Hour's 22 Minutes? And you're going to look at me and say, I will never appear on This Hour's 22 Minutes and just storm off. And he said, okay. And we did that. And we just put it at the end. And the reaction in the audience was huge. And I heard later that the reaction in the Reform Party was huge because they were like, you know, my son saw Preston on the show and apparently it's a cool show.
They reached a different demographic.
Yeah. And so everything changed then. It just changed. And even with Marg Delahunty, Mary Walsh, she would attack them and she would be vicious. My feeling was she could always say stuff that I wouldn't have been able to say anyway. She had this brilliant character who could do it. But they even came out of that good because they just stood there and took it.
It was more about what she said as opposed to
well, what she said was she would eviscerate them, but then people would have great sympathy for them because this poor man is standing there while this woman is yelling at him.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like they would both come out on top. Again, they would both come out on top.
It wasn't like a Borat or LEG thing where he was like setting them up to make fools of themselves.
No.
Contrast that with Talking to Americans.
Right.
Those people didn't know what they were getting into.
No.
And they would look like dipshits.
Do you think America should be bombing Bouchard?
Yes. Yes? Yes.
Congratulations, Canada, for getting a McDonald's.
Congratulations, Canada, 800 miles of paved road.
How about ground troops lining up and entering Gilles Duceppe? How do you feel about that?
Got to do what you got to do. If we're going to get in, it might as well get in all the way.
And how long do you think Gilles Duceppe could withstand the pounding?
Not much longer.
I always felt this was before YouTube. That's how old I am. I always thought these people will never see it. I don't know if I would have done it if I knew that they would possibly see it. And the first time I did Talking to Americans, again, it was a fluke.
And we put it on television, and the reaction was so huge. And my father called me, and he said, I saw that talking to Americans. And my father never commented on anything I ever did. Like, it was unheard of. And he said, I saw that talking to Americans. And I said, oh, yeah, it's crazy. The reaction is crazy. He said, oh, yeah, you know, Jerry Travers called and asked if you're going to do it again. And the neighbors came over and they said they liked it and they're wondering if you're going to do it again.
It was the most popular comedy special CBC ever aired.
But then Dad said, promise me you'll never, ever do that again. That's terrible. And then I said, okay. And then I didn't stop doing it for like 3 years.
But you felt bad about it.
He thought it was the worst thing. He was so deeply disappointed in me.
I mean, I went back and forth because I found it funny. And then I was like, why would they know these things?
No, why would they?
I don't know who the mayor of Louisville, Kentucky, like, it's much relevant.
It's not even that. It's like, of course we know who the president of the United States is. We live right next door to them. They're the biggest English market in the world.
They matter. We don't.
Yeah. Like, why would they know? Why would they know anything?
So I felt conflicted things about this because I don't sit in judgment because you are a performer and a comedian and you do tons of material. You put out hundreds or thousands of broadcasts and then something takes off like crazy, right? I think it's more of a reflection of Canada. And I think you've said this. You said that the fact that this was so popular that supposedly nice Canadians, we took such unmitigated glee in that these Americans think that we have an igloo, a national igloo.
Yeah,
and they you said this really revealed something small about us, you know, and
well, we wanted to feel superior. We wanted to feel smug. We wanted to look down our nose. As far as a joke goes, it's not an original joke. People have been talking about Americans showing up at the border in, you know, August looking for the ski hill.
Yeah.
Since the border's
ignorant.
Been there.
They look ignorant.
Yeah. But I always felt, or at least I told myself it was in good fun. These were early days, too. People didn't know that people were pranking. It was before YouTube, like I say.
Yeah.
Now people would avoid anyone with a camera. But I would say, excuse me, and the Americans would go, nope, because they assumed I was the supper hour show.
Uh-huh.
Nope. And then I'd say, I have a question from Canada. And they would go, oh, okay.
Right.
Like, they were all being polite to add.
Yeah, they were actually being nice to you.
They were being nice.
I think it says something about Canadians because there's a mean-spiritedness to, like, why that resonated. And then there's a lack of mean-spiritedness in the kind of political humor that resonated and made your other work such a big hit. Like when you are in jammies at 24 Sussex with Stephen Harper.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to rewatch that clip because you are saying things to him that were highly critical things. You're asking questions that a journalist should ask.
Why don't you let the cabinet ministers speak? Take a guy like Monty Solberg. Everyone likes Monty, you know, because he's a funny guy, had a blog.
He's a good guy.
Yeah, but since he's a minister, he's disappeared. I half expect to see him on a milk carton.
Oh, he's out there talking to new Canadians, trying to get this immigration system.
But then the idea is that he's sort of this, like, patient father who's exasperated with you and he puts you to bed and you're like in your jammies.
You know, when I can't sleep, I count ridings.
He's not the fool in that scenario. You're playing the fool in that scenario.
Yeah.
That's a very big difference from how they set it up in American satire. I think it says more about us, you know?
Well, I've been thinking about this because I have a book coming out, you know, in November.
So
it's about my years on the road with the Mercer Report. And I talk about all those shoots with various prime ministers. And the Harper one is a big one because a big part of my audience was just outraged. They were just could not believe I put Stephen Harper on television. But these are the same people who they didn't have any problem with Kretchen being on television or you know, any NDP leader being on television. But the fact that I would put Harper there was just infuriated them. We didn't expect it. We had a standing offer for him to come on the show and they wouldn't ever do it. And we would throw some ideas. And I guess the idea appealed to him that the conceit was I would be trying to do an actual interview and he would start killing me with kindness. So, you know, he would say, like, where are you staying tonight?
Yeah.
And I'd say, I'm at a hotel. You can't stay at a hotel. Stay with us. You know, are you hungry? I'll make you a sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
And the joke was pretty obvious. He despised the media and mm-hmm. he disliked people like me. So he got it. And the button was a really good button. The button, like, being the last thing you see was he shakes hands with his daughter, he shakes hands with his son, and then gives me a big hug, which was very self-deprecating because it was taking the piss out of his very first day or two on the job as prime minister. He
said goodbye to his children and shook their hands, and it became a huge story.
He was characterized as this robot man.
Cold, aloof guy. Yeah.
You've talked about how politicians would strategically appear on your show. Kretchen appeared with you in order to deflect headlines from Paul Martin.
That was the most obvious.
Yeah, like mutually parasitic.
Yeah.
They would use you. You'd
I didn't
use them.
See that one coming.
Uh-huh.
I always thought politicians would come on the show because they would look good. But with Kretchen came on the show and it was
smart.
A big deal. It was because he was the prime minister at the time and no prime minister had done that. And plus, we shot at Harvey. So it wasn't like I had a minute with him in his office. We shot across town in a restaurant. We took 2 hours of his day.
This is it. This is where you always eat.
Yeah. It's every 10 years. Like clockwork. After you, sir.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
It was a big deal. And I thought he's doing it because he wants to look good. But it was budget day in Canada. And the prime minister's office released all these photos of Kretchen and I shoving burgers in our mouth. And that photo literally appeared on the front page of many newspapers in Canada, knocking Paul Martin off the front page.
On the day that he destroyed the deficit.
Yeah.
It should have been a huge victory
for Paul Martin.
It should
have been Paul Martin's greatest day.
Kretchen, that crafty little fucker.
It was very
crafty. I kind of love him. I got to kind of – like. I think that's how a lot of people feel.
It was very crafty.
You know, again, it's different. And I also note that nobody replaced you. It's really – when Jon Stewart left, Trevor Noah came – you know, and then there were rival shows. There were all kinds of other attempts. It became a format. Who's going to be the next satirical voice doing this fake news American politics thing? Was there even an attempt to have the next Rick Mercer?
No, I thought – you know, the CBC asked me, was there anything I wanted to do next? But I was ready to step out because if I wanted to stay on TV, I would have kept doing the same show. But I did think briefly – maybe I'll just produce my show. Gerald and I would produce the show like we always produce the show. We just replace me.
Yeah.
And bring that to the CBC. But that was short-lived because that just seemed like
– and they didn't do it on their own, nor did any other network go for
it. And I'm assuming people walk through the door of the CBC saying, give me that time slot. Please, God, give me that time slot.
It's not done. Like, there's like political satire now. How many years are we into Trudeau now? Is it 8 years, 7 or 8 years now? He's a very mockable prime minister.
Yeah.
I cannot think of a decent Justin Trudeau impersonation. So why can't Johnny satirize? Why can't Johnny dissent? What's wrong with Canadians that we seem to be not interested? What's going on?
Oh, no. When I was on tour the last time, or my second last tour, I guess, I was talking about all the Trudeau blackface photos that had surfaced. And when they reached number 3, you would think number 3 is – That's going to take you up. Three photos,
three
blackface.
Blackface.
And then I said,
photos.
The greatest minds in the Liberal Party came together. How are we going to deal with this? And they came out. They said, he's not racist. He's just dumb. And then people were like, oh, okay. Oh, thank God. He's just dumb. And I remember performing that. And I really felt like, what? Like, you haven't heard jokes about the prime minister before? They're just three blackfaces. I mean –
and he won't put a number on how many more there might be out there.
No.
He can't recall. And
my favorite thing about Justin Trudeau too is every time he gets caught doing something, and all politicians get caught doing something, but it's always a time for us to reflect on our own selves.
Yeah.
You know, yes, there's a third photo of me in blackface. And Jesse, this is a time where you can reflect on your inherent bias towards various races.
Don't we all carry – aren't we all a little bit like –
well, this is not about
– I don't know that this is – yeah.
Yeah. But he's very good at that.
It's quite something. So the media environment today versus the media environment 10 years ago when I started taking shots.
Yeah.
And I remember before that walking into the CBC atrium and towering over me were the faces of – Peter Mansbridge and George Strombolopoulos,
right,
and John Gomeshi and Rick Mercer and Don Cherry, Enright and Kariloff. They give them smaller pictures somewhere else.
Radio, you know.
Yeah, it's radio.
Radio pictures, yeah.
All gone
from
the scene. And similarly to that there is no real heir apparent to your role as the kind of like signature political comedy guy, no one's really taken their places. It feels really fractured and it's almost like hard to even know what or who to get angry at. If you were a young, angry 19-year-old looking for that like well-known figure to take that big shot at, it's a very different environment right now, and it feels like we don't have, however flawed that pantheon of personalities might have been or whatever I might have had to say about them 10 years ago, it's really strange right now. It's almost like there is no center.
It's very hard to punch through. I actually did a 50 Cent with my second one-person show. I kind of took the lesson of taking on with Charles Lynch. And in my second one-person show, it took place in a post-apocalyptic world in Newfoundland where the Pickering power plant melted and all of these Canadians had to come to Newfoundland. And I played this High Lord executioner. There was this guy who was executing people we didn't want to let in. And I executed all of the sacred cultural cows, like Farley Mowat and Sharon Lois and Bram and even people, Margaret Atwood, even people that I grew to adore.
I mean, I know who you're talking about. I don't know if my staff would know.
And now if you had to say, if you wanted to do that same act now and say, you know, list these 10 Canadian iconic figures.
Take that, Farley Mowat.
And not like Drake, because he's an international figure.
Yeah.
But like 10 uber Canadian inside of our border figures, you'd have a hard time.
We are coming up on this 10th anniversary, and we are having a live show, and we were like, who could we get on stage
right.
that would have that resonance? And the list was Justin Trudeau, Pierre Poilievre, Chrystia Freeland. And none of them would do it.
No.
And then I couldn't think of anybody else. I'm like, to actually have that, like, Canada is on – or, you know, some significant personality right. of Canada is on stage here. And we came up empty. It's a strange position to be in at a time when the country is in the shape that it's in. It's being challenged. Like, yeah. figuring out who the heck we are is an open question. Part of the project here is trying to figure out where to go from here and how we all talk to each other. And, I wonder because, like, it seems like you kind of have earned, a comfortable spot, establishment guy, still doing comedy on the CBC. You've got a fan base across the country. You see this country on foot. Like, what do you see? Let's leave anger aside for a second. Are you more or less worried than you were when you started?
I'm probably worried about different things. I find it sad what you're saying about who is that figure we could bring out on stage that everyone would go, okay, we're in for a conversation now. When I started the Mercer Report, we did these celebrity tips where I would get a Canadian celebrity to film a little segment that were inspired by World War II training videos and just teach Canadians something that they should do. And famously, Pierre Burton came on and rolled the joint.
First of all, you need a good rolling service. May I suggest either the National Dream or my latest book, Prisoners of the North.
And I had Margaret Atwood teach Canadians how to stop a hockey puck.
I don't like to hot dog, but if the puck carrier is really putting lumber on it, then mama can get nasty.
And Ty Domi, how to set a Thanksgiving table.
Start with the basics. First, place settings, dump and chase.
Utensils are placed outside.
And it went on and on. And every time they would come up, you know, this celebrity tip featuring, and then you would see them, the audience would react because yeah. they knew who they were.
We
knew who those people were. And you're right. I eventually stopped doing the celebrity tips because I ran out. But now I don't know who you would get at all.
Yeah.
It's tough. In part, I think that's the fault of the public broadcaster. That's the fault of the media in Canada. They don't like to promote their own. Even back in the day when Peter Zosky left radio, mm-hmm. again, I don't know if your listeners know who Peter Zosky is, but when Zosky left radio, there was a movement at CBC. Well, whoever replaces them, it's going to be called This Morning. We don't want people walking around going, it's the Zosky show. And there was a period in time where they didn't want anyone's name in the title.
Yeah.
And this is a thing in Canada, which doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. This gets me angry. Because, of course, we always put my name in the title and we fought for that. And that wasn't because of ego. Honest to God, it was not because of ego. It was because we knew if we were going to build a brand, that would keep the show going and we needed to have my name as part of the title.
Well,
we needed to be Zosky.
It's showbiz. Well, I might be partially to blame because there was a turn when Sturzberg took over at the CBC and
right.
he was very into building a star system.
Sure, yeah.
And all that big head furniture of those big personalities was Sturzberg like, no, we are yeah. going to build these guys. And there was even a sense like, you know, billboards all across the country. Like some of these people, the ratings weren't very good, but the face was there. Like this guy's going to be famous yeah. whether you like it or not.
Yeah. We'll tell you who the stars were. Well, that was CBC in the 50s.
And then I think there was a lot written about host culture after the Gomeshi scandal.
Yeah.
And when all of those personalities aged out or outstayed their welcome, and Don Cherry and then Mansbridge, you know, what do they do at the National? Who's going to get the big chair? Four people get it, ensuring that nobody actually gets famous.
Yeah.
And now
– and talk about inertia.
Yeah.
Make a decision.
It's very Canadian.
But there's four people on the list.
Even when they decide to like, okay, Janelle Massa, it doesn't seem like it's the prize that it once was. And those people are like, I can take it or leave it. They're kind of like, I did that for a little while. Now I'm going to go do something else.
It's not just the CBC. Shaw famously does not put actors' names on their posters. And I would sometimes, you know, they'd have half-page ads in the Globe and Mail. And one of the great Canadian stage actors in the lead role. And I would take a picture of it and tweet it. Can anyone tell me this guy's name? Because it's not on the poster.
Right.
And then people would just politely tell me what his name is. But the point was always lost. Never mind his name is not above the title. His name is not on the poster.
Yeah.
And that's absurd to me. Like, that's not the way Broadway works. That's not the way major festivals anywhere else in the world
anything,
work.
Anything in this. Lisa Laflamme, number one broadcast, just like one of the very few personalities that everybody in the country knows. Well, we got a real problem here. Got to get rid of her.
Yeah.
I mean, that does seem like a specifically Canadian pathology.
It does indeed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weird one.
Rick, this has been really fun. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.